of our week. I just want you to pay attention to the very, very end of our talk. At the end of this session today, I'm going to make a couple of important announcements that are especially pertinent to exhibitors, now that I have, you know, a few of you in the room. But not until the end. We're not going to go to the mechanics. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for bringing the rain, those of you who came from out of town, because we really, really needed it. It's been a terrible drought here, and that drenching stuff that you had to walk through was, everybody in the whole city is just joy, nothing but joy, and I know you brought it with you. So make my announcement is that was it. Just thanks for the rain, and now we'll move on to the last two presentations. It's really a great honor for me to be able to bring here from London two of the greatest, I think, exemplars of current state of the art. One of whom is actually at the beginning of a long career, and the other, I think, is in the middle of a long career. And I'll begin by saying that I was very, very proud of Karen Blights when she told me that she had earned this a graduate fellowship at Camberwell College from Mills College, where she had graduated in comparative literature. Actually, she graduated in 1996. So she's just, that was just a couple of years ago, and she was going off, and she asked me if she should I really do this. She asked me, and I said, well, how can you resist? I mean, one, there's London, and two, Ron King lives there. And so, you know, my advice to you, Karen, is that you know, you quickly enroll in school, and then you rush over to Circle Press, and you bang on the door and tell them that you're willing to wash dishes, whatever it takes, but to work with him, you know, as a true apprentice would work with a true master. And fortunately, after being probably, you know, turned away a few dozen times, Ron finally relented and allowed Karen, you know, to come in and sweep the floor. And now, almost 12 years later, Karen has graduated, and she and her cohorts have formed a group called ARC. And ARC is an extension of the circle. So the circle that Ron has all his life created lives in an extended form with this new addition. After Karen graduated from Camberwell, she started in what we call the collaborative nature, and has been creating bookworks since 1997 in England, some of whom got immediate response because I think it was called Dolly, which was about a little cloned sheep, a poor unfortunate thing, and I think Karen probably felt sorry for it. But she quickly segued into books with machines, books with pop-ups and magnets and dynamic stages, where readers would be able to actively participate in, as she refers, debates around the issues that range from the evolution of language to the role of gender in the body in communication. Well, she's currently working, and I have seen, if any of you get a chance to see some of the video clips of some of the things that she's thinking about now, you're going to be amazed. They unroll. They're fantastic. And their body size, am I correct? I think they're almost the size of human beings in terms of height. And anyway, like I said, I've known Karen since her halcyon days at Mills, and I'm really pleased to be able to present her, Karen Blights.
Thank you, Peter. Good morning. Okay. So, Peter asked me to talk today about a recent project of mine called The Mechanical Word, which is a series of five mechanical books in which I constructed a form of mechanical language composed of cogs, cranks, levers, and gears. Now, it's at this point that I get 1,000 questions like, What does a mechanical language look like? How does it work? What's it for, anyways? So before I bring on the books, I thought I'd take you through the reasoning behind why I wanted to create a mechanical language in the first place, and how I set about establishing a mechanical grammar. At the time that this whole project began, I'd been looking at various properties of language. I was particularly interested in its power to define, and through definition create, the things, people, and events that take place in the world. In the hands of the media, I could see that words had the power to turn a cloned sheep from a miracle to a monster, and back into a miracle within the space of a page. Advertisers had the power to mold and to manipulate the attitudes, appearance, and aspirations of a generation. Declarations from head of state could steer the minds of a nation from indifference to fear and loathing. The power of words lies in their ability to command and control emotion. And what often gets lost in the process is the thing that is actually at the heart of the communication. Words are so often burdened by legacy, history, and emotional context. These things can so easily cloud and obscure the thing that is being said. Take an everyday newspaper headline like, "The United States bombs Iraq." The words evoke images of twin towers, good and evil, oil, religious conflict, cowboy presidents, and everything else. But what if you wanted to look at that sentence in a different light, as a mathematical or a scientific equation, say? You might get something that looks like this. So I thought about that and wondered, could there be another kind of writing system that would allow you to peel back the complex histories embedded in proper nouns and the prejudices tied up in emotive adjectives? Could you abstract language in such a way as to allow you to communicate the core essence of a thought or idea? And if you could, would this allow people to receive a different perspective or a clearer understanding of information conveyed in any given event? So that was the problem I set about to solving. And to be sure, this was a pretty big problem. I had no idea where to start. So the first thing I did was look at how we are taught about words, how they are ordered, what part they play, and how they line up next to each other. And I came across this page from the Montessori Grammar Book. What I liked about it was the idea of relating abstract symbols and shapes, taking circles and squares, and assigning them to parts of speech. Triangles representing nouns, colors representing adjectives, and so on. I started to play around with some simple sentences, breaking them down into geometric forms. So here we have a very simple sentence. Jill pushes Jack. So what happens here? So Jill pushes Jack. She pushes him. She does him. Subject does object. Subject, verb, object. Circle, triangle, arrow. Okay, so I connected some shapes. You have the circle as the subject, the arrow as the verb, but these static shapes didn't do or say much. They didn't tell me anything at all about Jill pushing Jack. I was particularly disappointed with the arrow in the middle. The verb is so fundamental to what's going on in this sentence. Clearly, Jack fell down and broke his crown, but the little arrow doesn't bring the scenario to life. It didn't tell me anything about the nature of pushing, the verb to do, which pushing is a form of doing, and it doesn't tell me anything else. You see, the arrow, it's a doing, it's an action, it's active, it should be dynamic, it should be moving. Pushing is forceful. And then you can't forget that in the end, someone got pushed. I soon realized that in order to get these symbols to represent that idea better, they themselves had to be dynamic. But how could I get them to start moving around? Could machines do the job of illustrating direction, force, and motion? So I started to play around with that idea. And here's an example of what I began to imagine a conversation between a guy and a girl might look like. Okay, clearly the guy has some issues here. They always do. There's indecision going on here on both sides. But obviously, she sees it in a very different way, she being the little one. You can kind of get a vague sense of what's being communicated with these machines. Not really. But a real translation's harder to arrive at. Okay, so what if they said something like, it's immature, but you have to go with this here. Why can't you make up your mind? It's me or her. And he says something like, I love you, but my mom does my laundry. But then, you can cook. But then again, okay. So looking at that translation, it became immediately apparent that trying to read or communicate through machines wasn't as straightforward as I thought it was going to be. I couldn't just invent some complicated machine and just expect it to mean something. I realized that, like any other language, in order for people to encapsulate and communicate ideas, a mechanical language would require not only a kind of component alphabet, but also a form of regulatory grammar, which would dictate how the configuration of the parts should be read. It needed structure. I needed to establish some rules. So where do you start when beginning to build, from scratch, a mechanical language? Okay, well, in any sentence, you start with the subject. Then, the subject has to be or do something. And we've already established that the verbs come next because verbs are the things that move a sentence. They're the motivators, the force. Together with the subject, verbs are at the core of all of our thoughts and actions. So which verbs? I decided to focus on to be, to do, to have, and to go. I chose these four because in my adventures into the convoluted world of linguistic analysis, which you don't want to go there, it's quite... Anyways, I had come across the idea that all of the other verbs that we use are simply, or not so simply, more complicated expressions of doing, pushing, poking, prodding, making, going, walking, running, leaving, returning, having, wanting, desiring, possessing, claiming. In a nutshell, all of the wants, needs, aspirations, desires, and actions of man can all be reduced to four very simple verbs: being, doing, having, and going. So that's it. That's the basis of all language. Four verbs. Man is essentially a sadly simple, though we make him complex, he's a sadly simple animal, with only four basic needs, desires, or states of existence. Okay, so how can we use all of that to not only express a simple sentence with machines, but also to learn something about the words in that sentence? Okay, so now that I've got circles representing subjects, I now needed to bring in the forceful, active part of the sentence. And I'll start with be, because you have to be before you can do, have, or go anywhere, so we'll just start there. Okay. Now, here's what being looks like in a traditional, grammatical, diagrammatic breakdown of a sentence. Bit horrible. Okay, so I'm going to get rid of the horrible stuff. Okay, what do we have? The little stars beside the big star, okay. I'll just get rid of that. Stars. Star is. So the star, we'll say that's the subject, the circle, is. The circle is. And if we add rotation here to the circle, you have a dynamic representation of the verb to be. So let's make our own schematic diagram of to be, just to confuse everybody at 8:30 in the morning. Okay, so you have you. You add some rotation to that circle, clockwise, plus happy. You are happy. Counterclockwise, You are unhappy, you're sad. Not rotating at all. You're neither happy nor unhappy, you just are. Okay. With all of that established, let's see if we can create a simple sentence. We'll start with something like, you and I are friends. Okay, so we've got here two subjects. We've got you, the little blue guy. We've got I over here. And you and I are in a shared state of friendship represented by the stripy bit there, okay? Now, if you and I are friends, how does your being affect my being? So we'll add some rotation to you. Say, you are being a jerk. And the result of that is that I am no longer in a state of friendship with you. I'm over there in the black bit. I hate you. But then, if you reverse that rotation, and you start being nice, I will resume my state of friendship with you. Okay. So what's the point of all of that? Okay. We'll go on here. Maybe by looking at that situation in a mechanical sort of a way, you can see that being, your state of being, might have an effect on other beings, right? So it makes you ask, what does being do? Am I just being here? Does my being influence anything? Does it cause anything to happen? Well, sometimes it does. Okay, so we're just going to go crazy with that for a second and see where that leads us. Okay, here we have you again sitting in the center. And you are connected to all these other things. Your being can kick off a chain of events that even though I might not be directly connected to you, I am or am not. Oh, I've got this funny thing at the bottom of the screen. You'll have to forgive that. I am or am not something or other. I'm getting blown apart here. As a result of something that you are or are doing. So being seems to be connected to doing. Okay, so we're going to go there next. And doing brings us back to good old Jack and Jill. Or Jill pushing Jack. So what's doing all about? Okay, say you've got the subject again on the right. And we'll add a bit of rotation to that again. But then this time we'll also give the subject something like a little arm. With which to reach out and do things to other objects, like poke them. So there it is in action, the great poke. And did you notice that as a result of that, the object of the poke, the pokey, has now shifted state as a result of the encounter. So when you look at it this way, you get a couple of different ideas about what doing is all about. First of all, you start to see that words and actions don't usually exist in isolation. Words act on each other. They have an effect on each other. And whether it's apparent or not, there's a chain of reaction. Which leads us to another interesting thing about the do machine. That the do machine has to say about language. Unlike our letters and words, and the sentences you build out of those words, a mechanical language is not necessarily linear. You don't have to line up all the pieces next to each other in the same way that you do with a sentence. Machines can operate in more than two dimensions. They can be connected in space and through time. For example, if the triangle, Jack here, is connected through the page to a cog on the other side of the page, it's my clever little, PowerPoint madness here, which is in turn connected to another cog and so on. Let's see. I'll show it to you in another way so you can see it better. Okay, so there it is. You've got the two pages, two different sides of the pages. And the one on top, the black and white one, you've got Jill pushes Jack, like that. And then there's an axle connecting Jack, the triangle, through the page to the cogs beneath. And suddenly, the equilibrium between the cogs becomes upset by something that happens without them even knowing about it. On the other page, in a different time, and in a different place. So if you expand that, you might get something like, Jill pokes Jack. Jack falls down and breaks his crown. Jack loses his job. Jack can't make his mortgage repayments. A subprime lending crisis ensues. And the global economy goes to pot. The end. Or maybe that's just the beginning. Who knows? Okay, so you can see where we could go on making up all these little machines forever. But there is a 20-minute parameter to this talk, so I'm going to quickly run through some of the other things that I found out about. To have. Here it is, have the machine. It's the subject, the circle, equipped with a simple lever. So what does the lever do here? Let's see it. Ah, he's got it. Okay. When I started to play around with this one, I was struck by the physical structure of the machine. The movement of its component parts had its own stories to tell about the nature of the word to have. You've got all these different things going on here with having. There's the circle with the lever, the haver, which means that the subject now has the ability to leverage things towards itself. And then you've got the triangle who's being had, the havee. So the verb to have, there's two parts to that, the haver and the havee. And in order for the haver to get the havee, there's got to be things like want, desire, and covet built into the mechanism somewhere in order for the leverage to happen. So having is much bigger than just I have. It's I see it, I want it, I have to have it. All of these things have to be in place in order for anybody to have anything, in order to reach out and activate that kind of motion. And if you contextualize the haver by adding a background, you can get some other ideas about having. Having can also be about procuring, discovering, unearthing, or revealing. And there's also something to be said about by the form of the machine. The circular subject, the circle, is round. There's a cycle. If the lever completes the cycle, there it is, loss. Having incorporates losing. You know, how can you have anything? You're born, you acquire, you have, and then you die. You lose. You can't actually take anything away with you. There's always this horrible, unavoidable downside to the word have. You have, you lose, and then you put two havers in a room together, and look what happens. As soon as they both start trying to have, you can immediately see that having also incorporates some level of conflict. There's not a lot of comfort between these two guys here. And if you contextualize that, you can have two people, two kings, two nations, and if you named one of them Israel and the other one Palestine, will the built-in cycle of the verb ever let one side win? Does looking at the conflict in an abstract way, stripping back the proper nouns with their histories and the emotions they evoke, can stripping all that back to look at a situation in a different way shed any light on a situation? Which takes us back to the original premise. If you have a situation or a sentence that has all these proper nouns, adverbs, and adjectives that cloud the sentence with emotion, could you rewrite it with machines and look at it just like this, in the pure abstract form, so you can get a better sense of what is the conflict? What is the cause and the true nature of the conflict? Where is the conflict going? Is it going anywhere at all? That's my segue into the verb to go. Okay, so going. When you try to give go a machine body, the physical problem of trying to get a circle to go anywhere throws up some interesting ideas about what going is all about. The problem lies in the fact that the circle isn't physically capable of going anywhere at all by itself. And it makes sense. I mean, you don't just go anywhere for no reason at all. There's always an additional component to motion. You go across the room to the kitchen because you're hungry and you want to get some food. So if we break that one down and look at it, you start to see that going always comes in pairs. There's a good pair. The cat runs away from the dog. Or the boy lunges towards the girl. Frustrated, the boy leaves. So what does that look like in full motion? Okay, so cat runs away from the dog because the dog is a generally repugnant and smelly beast. The boy is attracted to the girl. So you get the picture. Not only that the subject is inextricably linked to some object somewhere by an urge or a kind of compulsion or repulsion, but you can also see in the compound machine that going has a directional force involved, and that where you're coming from or going to matters. In other words, direction counts. It's kind of like a modifier in a sentence. It adds information about all of the elements surrounding the act of going. For example, you got us versus them. And if one of us goes over to them, is to desert. He's a deserter. But if you flip that around, and you start off the other way with one of the guys in the blue camp, and reverse the direction such that one of them decides to come over to us, to convert. He's a convert. So again, the context, the way you put these symbols together, whether they're leaving or joining the group, decides whether or not it's a positive or a negative thing, deserting or converting. Okay, so I think I'm very close to my 20 minutes now here, so I'm just going to show you some of the actual books here, one of them, a couple of them. So all of the ideas that I brought out to play with here appear in their own way in each of the books that makes up the Mechanical Word series. In this talk, I've pulled out some of the sketches and the animations that were generated in and around the creation of the mechanical language in order to give you a few different thoughts about the hidden dynamics of language and the way that words have their own laws, which govern the relationships and interactions between them. This is the book, the last one in the series called Long Gone to Go. And you'll notice that there's two different sets of text. The black and white side is where I introduce the grammar, the verb in its isolation. And then I did some text along with that that sort of highlights the circles and shows the actions and the dynamics within that sentence, sort of the grammar intro part. And then this side is in a more complicated sentence with a poem by a Scottish poet named Richard Price. So that sort of illustrates what's going on between the characters involved on that one. And I'll just quickly... That's the set of five. This is a close-up of wrecking ball to be, hard done from to do, hold up to have. That's the flip side of that. Digesting. That was a lot.
She is, you're adjusting to the new world. Karen is a native of California. She's one of our finest exports.
Peter.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There's a question down
there. Oh, question. I can't see very
well. Left. There. You. Yeah.
Well, my question is that you refer to the clockwise rotation as happy and the counterclockwise as unhappy. And then as you start the motion within the book, at the turning of the page immediately creates clockwise into counterclockwise. Mm. It's sort of like, you know, screwing in, screwing out, or maybe getting screwed or not getting screwed.
There's librarians in the room.
The line just floated, but it's falling soon. So I'm wondering if you have, you know, taken that into, you know, context as well, that the actual moving from the outside to the inside or from one side to the other, in fact, reverses the entire influence, that is, the intent, if you will.
Well, that's what I was pointing out with that stripey. The happy bit in the first part with the diagram was just sort of the condition. So you are plus some condition X, and so that happy could have been replaced with anything else. And yeah, the rotation thing. Well, I mean, the mechanical language is one of those things where you play around with it, but then you quite quickly realize that actually you can't build a whole entire real functioning speakable language, because you go around one direction and then the next person who picks up the book turns it the opposite direction, and you can't control your reader. So they have to make of it what they will, and they sometimes turn it the wrong way, even though I try to control that. But,
I have a comment. You did point that out on the first one, is to be.
Yeah.
Because I think you didn't quite understand the question. You were showing, you said, when you're doing this, actually on the other side.
Oh, you mean on the flip side of the page?
Yeah, the flip side, red and the green, it does react negatively on the other side.
On the other side.
The one side makes a reaction on the other side, so there is a reaction. You did take that into context, what happens on the other side.
Oh, well, yeah, because the what happens on the other side, that's sort of about causality, and sort of, so on one side of the page, the activities between two, like if you go to this one here, the activities of the black and white pair, they think they're just acting in isolation, but the black one is actually connected to the red one on the right there. And so here you've got this love triangle going on. It's like Sartre's no exit. These three are trying to sort themselves out. And he's trying to make up his mind between these two girls, and they keep running back and forth. But actually, the cycle that the red and the blue guys are locked in is determined by what's happening between the black and the white guys. So, I mean, in life it happens like that all the time. You know, you think that what you're doing, it's just all about you. But actually, what happened yesterday to some guy over there somehow has some kind of butterfly effect that reaches out and attacks you like 2 years later, and you mm-hmm. didn't even know about it.
Yeah. I just kept thinking of epigraphers when I was.
Of a what?
Epigraphers, people who figure out language. And I knew a woman named Linda Shealy who wrote the Maya Code. And the way she did it, her background was as an artist. And she saw patterns and repetition and sort of paired away what the language was. And she is the one that was finally able to decipher what the codexes were
Well, I mean, that was the original goal, was to pare it down, to make it naked and look at the bones underneath it, so that you could sort of get away from all the stuff that just clouds your judgment, and so that you could reanalyze or reevaluate something without all that other stuff that makes it so that people kind of get crazy when you say a certain word, and it makes it so that they just actually can't make correct or logical decisions sometimes when you go bombing other countries and things like that. So, yeah.
We have time for one more.
I have one brief question, which is how these things are activated, and the other is the diagrams and emotions remind me of Freudian analysis. And so, I guess I want to know, can you take these machines and make them activate in a kind of emotional sexual references?
Did you say emotional sexual references?
Yeah.
Why is everyone going here? To answer your question. Good. The dirty beast that man is. Yes. I always like to get down to that at the bottom of my talk. To answer your first question, how they're activated is you'll see it here when it comes around again. In the black and white page, notice the white the white one has a little thing sticking out of it. That's actually a little knob. And we're not going to say the word sexual after knob. But anyway, there's a knob, and you crank it around, and then that kicks off the first set, and then the ones on the back are connected to that. So it.
You have to understand my questions are directed at the feminism.
It's okay. I went to Mills College. I know about feminism.